Welcome to the Tennis Worthy Podcast, brought to you by the International Tennis Hall of Fame. I'm Patrick McEnroe, the Hall of Fame's president, and it gives me immense pleasure to introduce this episode, which is devoted to arguably the greatest men's doubles team of all time, inductees in the Hall of Fame's class of 2025, Bob and Mike Bryan.
The number one lesson that you have to learn in sports is how to lose. I mean, there's a lot of adversity. We won a lot, but we actually lost a lot, too.
I think we probably lost more than any other team.
We lost out there 300-400 matches, right? And those are all heartbreaking moments.
Terrible things we would say to each other, but a lot of times we just blow it out. You know, 5 minutes later, we're having dinner, and the next day, we're coming with a clean slate to practice. But you see teams sometimes go through these bad periods where the resentment builds until the team breaks apart. There was never a time where we thought we were going to break up.
Our goal for a long period of time had been to win a gold medal. And coming into the Olympics in London in 2012, we'd already played two Olympics. We kind of thought in our mind that was our last chance at it. We had all the records, but where's the gold? You know, that was kind of the asterisk.
And the greatest team of all time, you know, before us, the Woodies, they had the gold.
For the first couple of decades after tennis went open, the top singles players also played doubles. So you had marquee pairs such as Emerson and Laver, Newcomb and Roach, Hewitt McMillan, Fleming and McEnroe. That would be John McEnroe, by the way. But as the competition and physicality increased, the top names played less and less doubles. In the 1990s, we had the Woodies from Down Under and the colorful Jensen brothers. But as the new century dawned, doubles was in need of fresh standard bearers. Into this void stepped a dynamic, charismatic, successful, and extremely good-natured pair of identical twins. And the rest, as they say, is history. Tennis historian Chris Bowers charts the story of the legendary Bryan twins.
If you wanted to devise a template for generating a world-beating doubles pair that was naturally talented, immersed in tennis, well-taught, and brought up with a sense of responsibility to the sport, you'd be hard-pressed to find a better model than Bob and Mike Bryan's family background. In the 60s, their mother, Kathy Blake, played in the dying days of the all-amateur circuit, reaching doubles quarterfinals at Forest Hills and Wimbledon, while their father, Wayne Bryan, played for the University of Southern California and then bought a tennis club, where he was the owner and coach. Bob and Mike take up the story. They're identical twins, so sound very similar. It's Mike you hear first.
My mom played Wimbledon 5 times. She was a top junior in the country. She was the talent of the family. And then my dad went to law school and then actually bought a club. Never practiced law. Got the opportunity to buy this club, and he loved tennis so much that he started managing and running the junior program at the club. My mom and dad met at an exhibition event. My mom was actually playing, and my dad was in the chair doing the commentary and emceeing. And they fell in love that day, and they got married, a few weeks later. So
they honeymooned down in New Zealand playing pro tournaments. My dad says he was on the tour long enough to have a cup of coffee. So he was just playing a few tournaments with my mom, mixed doubles. But then he settled in at the club. They both taught lessons. We're little toddlers sitting in their baskets. But it was a magical environment that they created there for us.
We've seen pictures. I think we were 2 or 3 with little rackets in our hand. And we just grew up at the club, running around. I mean, we were always around the courts, but we were maybe swimming in the pool or making forts in the back of the club. But we were always at the club in that environment. I think we played our first tournament at age 6. And I'm pretty sure we played a tournament every weekend.
Yeah.
Because they had the local tournaments, and it was just a way of life. It was just, we'd wear tennis clothes at school. You know, I remember wearing like little wristbands and like a headband at school.
The school bus would drop us off at the club, and we would play 4 hours a day. Usually an hour of that was my mom feeding us balls, you know, putting up with our crap while we sometimes bickered. But she kind of molded our strokes, gave us great technique, footwork, and then my dad ran this huge clinic every day for 100 kids. It was high energy, tons of fun, lots of screaming and laughing by the kids. And that was what we really loved. We were always together. I don't think we spent a moment apart until Jay Berger sent you home during the Australian Open Juniors.
Yeah, we were just a package deal all the way. We slept in the same bedroom. A lot of times we were like sleeping in the same bed because it felt natural for twins. Just, you know, we were 9 months in the womb. So I think we even had our own twin language, which yeah. We had to go to speech therapy to kind of unwind that. But we had these twin words that no one could understand just because we were always together. Our parents tried to separate us. Like some pediatrician said, you should separate twins and put them in different rooms, but we just cry all night. And so that only kept up for, you know, a week or so. And then they put us together and we stopped crying.
One thing our parents always kind of stressed was sportsmanship and being grateful. Calling the lines fairly, respect your opponent, respect the umpire. We'd always, every Monday after the tournaments, my dad would have us write thank you letters to the tournament directors and teachers. Whoever's helping us out, we'd always try to give our thanks. They were very smart about how they motivated us. They took us to college matches on the weekends. We went to see Agassi, Currier, Chang at the Great Western Forum when we were just little guys. We were ball kids down at UCLA for the pro tournament, just running around getting autographs at these great events. Our eyes were huge. We fell in love with the game. We had idols like Andre Agassi, posterized our room. We cut out any picture out of the magazine of Andre and tape it on the wall. We were in this fan club and memorized all the middle names of all the pros, had the rankings down by heart. So yeah, we were just immersed in tennis from a young age.
What a remarkable childhood, and a perfect one for kids who wanted to make it as tennis professionals. But that doesn't guarantee that they could form a good doubles partnership together. Yet doubles was really the only option on the table. Kathy and Wayne Bryan had a philosophy for their twins that put doubles ahead of singles. And while both boys played singles, it was never allowed to create a situation where one might be better than the other. Bob first.
I think their philosophy is they wanted us to be tight and love each other as brothers and not be competitive in the house. You know, every kid has dreams of being number one in the world. And those dreams can be squashed if you're losing to your brother who's across the room. So we support each other. We were trophy collectors. That was our big thing. We had one big shelves in our room, and we would put our trophies up. We'd play singles and doubles every weekend, trying to collect as many as we could get. And it was Mike and Bob's trophies. It was never, there's Mike's and there's Bob's. So we didn't start playing against each other until we were about 16 or 17 when people started buying tickets to the matches. But I think this helped our relationship. We supported each other on the court. And I don't know. I think that was a very smart play by my parents.
Yeah, we played our first tournament at age 6, and we met in the singles final. And we were getting ready to play the match, and our parents were like, okay, you guys aren't going to play. You're just going to flip a coin for it. We flipped the coin. I think I got the bigger trophy. You got the smaller trophy. But then we went out and played the doubles, too. So we brought four trophies home. And we didn't care, you know. We, as Bob said, we were trophy collectors. We just had one room, lined them all up, shined them, looked at them every day. And we did that all the way from 6 years old until we were 16. And then tournament directors and people started saying, you guys got to play. Yeah. And so we started playing, and it was pretty equal once we started. But it did help our relationship. You know, we always kind of supported each other. No one was saying, okay, Bob's better or Mike's better. That talk, there was like, okay, the Bryan brothers. And there were times where maybe one of us was better, but no one cared. And I think it would have demoralized one twin if one started winning.
And that pooling of trophies extended into prize money. Whatever the Bryans won, including mixed doubles earnings, when one was on the court while the other wasn't, went into a joint bank account. And they kept that up for their entire playing career. And they were always together, in class, in their bedroom, in the car, which helped them build up a phenomenal understanding. As juniors, weekends meant tournaments, often with early starts, the four Bryans in a car driving to a tennis facility. But the twins insist there was never any parental pressure on them to win. The Bryans turned professional in 1998 at the age of 20, and the following year they reached their first final on the clay of Orlando. Their first title came 2 years later in Memphis, a few weeks before their 23rd birthdays. They quickly established themselves as one of the half dozen best pairs in the world, winning three more tournaments in 2001 and five in 2002. But what they wanted, and everyone was beginning to expect, was a Grand Slam title. Yet their best was two semi-finals. That is, until they got to Paris in 2003. Mike first.
Coming into the 2003 French Open, we still hadn't won a Grand Slam.
Hadn't made a final.
We hadn't even made a final, but we were knocking on the door. We'd beaten all the top teams. We'd beaten the Woodies, who are the greatest team of all time. We'd won Masters Series. We'd won a lot of tournaments, but still they were saying, okay, the Bryans, they haven't done it. They haven't won the big one. And in the back of our mind, we were saying, okay, like, are we ever going to do it? So for that tournament in particular, we put so much focus on that one. We got to Paris, I think, a week early, and we trained. We were just dialed in. And we were playing well going in there, but we literally put everything we had into that tournament, and it all started clicking. You know, but we felt like we prepared so well.
We did, but we did have tough losses leading into that. It was a long clay court season for us. We just lost in the semis at Hamburg, kind of knocking on the door. We thought we could get over the hump there. It was disappointment. We decided to go to Paris a week early, and we didn't have a ton of money at the time. You know, we were doing okay, but as doubles players, you got to be dominating to make a lot of money. And so we stayed at a very cheap hotel. It was a junior hotel. The lights were on motion detectors, and so you'd walk down the hallway and the lights would turn on as you got to your room. I just remember the beds being so hard that it was tough to sleep. You know, the breakfast was only those little twisty cereal things where the cereal would just kind of come out. So we were undercooked on sleep. We were malnourished, but we were playing well. Like, we just started finding a groove. And in the run up to the final, like, I don't think one set hit four. Like, we were just feeling it. We were really nervous, so because the beds were hard, but we were jittery at night. But we were just riding adrenaline. And we played two seasoned veterans in the finals, Kafelnikov, who'd won the singles there, Harhaus, who's one of the greater doubles players ever. It was a tight match. I remember winning the first set in a breaker, and we were down 3-2 in the second set, and we won 16 points in a row. So it happened like that. And we were both in shock. I remember seeing the video. We both went to our knees. Never done that before, but it was like Bjorn Borg when he won Wimbledon. Yeah. And Mike came up, and we both hugged each other. We had clay all over our shirts. It's all a blur. Took the trophies out to the Champs-Élysées, partied into the wee hours of the night, and actually went straight to a photo shoot from the club. Shirt smelled like smoke, you know. Photos are unusable.
Yeah. Coming in, we had so many superstitions. We ate at this Chinese restaurant 21 straight nights in a row. So the first night we got there, it just felt good. It was totally empty because this was pretty bad Chinese food. They actually let us play our music in the restaurant because there's no one there. So we'd always give our Dave Matthews CD. Yeah. And we'd listen to the same song on the way to the courts. It was just, yeah, we had so many little... We were pretty OCD because we just wanted it so bad. Bob would take a shower in the same shower. I'd be over here. I started drawing, like, happy faces on my racket. And it was just like we had to do the same thing every day. But we had so much, like, nervous energy. And we came out of the gates in every match, like, so energetic. And we had this twin vibe where we're bouncing around together. And, like, it just, like, we overwhelmed them with, like, the energy. And we coming in, we lost a few tight matches where we're like, okay, we gotta kill these teams, or if it gets close, you know, you never know what's gonna happen. So we would get up a break, and we're like, let's get the double break, let's keep going. So we killed pretty much every team.
But there was a key to winning which wasn't widely apparent at the time, but which the Bryans now claim unlocked their potential. They were mirror twins, meaning one was left-handed, Bob, and the other right-handed, Mike. Until then, the convention for a lefty-righty pair was for the right-hander to play in the deuce court and the left-hander to play in the advantage court. And that's how the Bryans had played. Until 3 months before that breakout 2003 French Open.
We've been on a tour for about 4 years, and we've had success, but we weren't knocking the door down. So we decided to switch sides. I went to the deuce court, and Mike went to the ad court. It was a change. We had a successful college career and junior career, but we decided that maybe the flip, it was the right time just to change it up.
That adjustment where Bob went to the deuce court and me going to the ad, that kind of unlocked our games because it gave us the ability to poach with the forehand volley. And in doubles, a lot of the points are won in the middle, and our strongest shots are our forehands. So we had two forehands in the middle, which was unconventional to the past great teams, like McEnroe, Fleming, the Woodies. Yeah. They were righty-lefty, but they had their forehands on the outside. So this shift was like, what are they doing? Okay, that's not smart. But we loved the forehands in the middle. Bob was one of the greatest poachers with that. You get more reach, you get more power when you're poaching with a forehand volley. Mm-hmm. And then we like to run around and hit inside out. So that was a shift that kind of surprised teams, but it unlocked this new gear in our games where we never looked back. We did that the rest of our career.
That first major title didn't just put the Californian twins on the Grand Slam roll of honour. 3 months later, after reaching the final of the US Open, they were the joint world number one doubles players. And that opened up something else to them. Tennis's premier and oldest team competition, the Davis Cup. Bob explains why.
Davis Cup was a big thing to us. You know, Davis Cup, you know, all our heroes and idols were playing this competition. You know, they're representing the United States with the cool warm-ups and, you know, walking out to, you know, they're like rock stars walking out onto the stage. And we went down to La Jolla when we were little guys. We painted our faces. We had flags in our hats. And we were rooting for these guys. You know, Ricky Leach was out there, who was our doubles idol at the time. And I just remember they're cheering on the United States with Mike. Ricky even acknowledged us when he was walking down to the court. He, like, said hi to us, and we were blown away. So that was always, you know, a dream, is to get onto the Davis Cup team. I don't know how we're going to do it, but maybe one day, if we keep putting in the hours, that will be a reality. You know, we got on the tour. We started knocking off some of these guys that had played Davis Cup that were, you know, legends. We played against our idol, Ricky Leach. Started becoming something that maybe we thought we had a chance to do. Then Patrick McEnroe, there was only four spots on the Davis Cup team. And he didn't want to risk two doubles players taking up four of those spots. We could understand it, because if a singles player gets injured, what are they going to do? So he kept dangling the carrot out in front of us. You know, no, you a Masters Series is not good enough. You got to win a slam. We win a slam. No, you got to be number one in the world. So we kept just, oh my God, when's it going to happen? And even fans were fighting that fight for us. Hey, when are you going to put the Bryans? They deserve it. But Pat, you know, kept kind of pushing us. And finally, French Open came, hit number one in the world, and we got our shot.
Patrick McEnroe, the 1989 French Open men's doubles champion, had been made US Davis Cup captain in 2001 after a turbulent 2000 in which his brother John was captain. Patrick was well aware of the Bryans, but in those days, captains could only select four players. So opting for a specialist doubles team with neither member a recognised singles player was a big risk. But with the US struggling to find a reliable second singles option after Andy Roddick, McEnroe opted for the Bryans for America's promotion and relegation match against Slovakia in Bratislava in September 2003. And with the weekend level at 1-1 after the opening day's singles, the doubles became pivotal. The Bryans faced Slovakia's top players, Carol Beck and Dominic Hrbatý, and won in straight sets. But it was far from straightforward. And having waited so long for their chance to play Davis Cup, there were a lot of nerves at play. Bob takes up the story.
It was a relegation match. Roddick was on the team. He had just won the US Open. It was just a hell of a week to be a part of this. So much energy involved in the experience. And I remember playing our first match. Patrick McEnroe came to us before the match and said, guys, I know there's a lot of pressure, but you're our team for years to come, which gave us the confidence that we knew we didn't have to win that one match. He took the pressure off of us. We played a great match. We won in straight sets, but at the end, I don't know, you can tell the story, but Mike started cramping. We're indoors playing a doubles match.
I've only cramped one time in my career, but it was so much pressure and so many nerves. I started cramping in like an hour and a half match. Davis Cup for us, what was the competition that we wanted to play? Like we're team guys. As a doubles team, literally it's the highest you can go playing for your country. And seeing it as little guys, it just looked like the most exciting competition that you could be a part of. You know, you go to Wimbledon, the crowd's polite, but you go to a Davis Cup match and they're chanting USA and they got their faces painted. And it's just so much excitement that we wanted to be a part of it. And when we came on the tour, that was our number one goal, is we want to play Davis Cup. We want to get ranked high enough to play for our country.
And you're playing for something more than yourselves. And that's why we love college tennis. You know, having a group goal, working every day to try to knock down that NCAA trophy. Well, this is on a grander stage.
The Bryans became a fixture in a very settled US Davis Cup team and went unbeaten in the competition until April 2005, when the dream team of Roddick, Agassi and the Bryans lost at home to a Croatian team led by Ivan Ljubicic at the peak of his career, the Croats going on to win the Cup that year. But 2 years later, in Portland, Oregon, the Bryans got their reward, Bob hitting the winning overhead as the US won their first Davis Cup title for 10 years. Looking back on the confetti falling from the ceiling and the general razzmatazz, the Bryans say this was probably the coolest moment of their career. In total, they won 24 Davis Cup doubles. No other pair in history has come close to that. The period between their first major in 2003 and their retirement in 2020 is an unbroken string of successes. They regularly won 5 titles in a year, and 3 seasons they won 11. But there are 3 moments in particular that stand out. Despite the high of their French Open title in 2003 and their undisputed status as the pair to beat, it took another 27 months before they won their second major. In fact, going into the 2005 US Open, there was a risk that the Bryans were becoming the team who could comfortably reach major finals but not win them. Mike first.
Actually, we made 5 Grand Slam finals. You know, we made the US Open final in 03, another one in 04, and then we come to 05. We're still doing great. We're still the most consistent team, but we haven't solidified that we're Grand Slam champs. We haven't won the next one. Yeah. And we just got to this point where we played safe. You know, we get into the big moments, and we're like, okay, we're favored to win. We just have to play okay or B-level tennis. And in 05, we lost the Aussie Open. We lost the French Open final. We lost Wimbledon final. And we come around to the U.S. Open, and we're in the final again, and we're playing for their – they start calling it the anti-slam because, you know, if you win all 4 in 1 year, it's the slam. But now it's – no one's ever done it in the history of tennis, lost all 4 in 1 year. So we would have been the biggest losers.
It was a big moment losing the Wimbledon final. We were the number 1 seed, and in the final we drew a qualifier team, a team that – was ranked outside the top 100 on paper. The odds makers would put us, you know,
99%.
Yeah, 99% chance to win the title.
We were like relaxed and laughing, like we're like, God, this is it. We're playing a qualifying team,
and we came out. You know, we played okay, but they went for it and they struck us down. And I remember you were crying after that match.
Yeah, I think you were crying too.
We were both crying together. No, that one hurt. But that summer, we hired our coach, David McPherson, who was with us for 15 years during our career. And when we got to the finals of the U.S. Open, he told us, guys, you know, be alpha dogs. No one's going to hand you this title. No one gives you Grand Slams. You got to go win it. And we just took a complete different mentality into that final. That might be the best match we've ever played. We beat our big rivals at the time, Bjorkman and Mirny, who were number 2 in the world. We beat them in 40-something minutes, 6-1, 6-4, in Arthur Ashe Stadium, which is the biggest stadium in the world. You know, that was just a huge moment for us.
As players brought up to value team tennis more highly than individual tennis, the other big team prize alongside Davis Cup was the Olympics. They lost in the quarterfinals in Athens in 2004, and they were beaten by the eventual gold medalists Federer and Wawrinka in the Beijing semifinals in 2008. That left them ultra-determined to win gold in London in 2012, the tennis event played at Wimbledon. Not just because it was a team prize, but also because they were the undisputed best pair, but had a blank in their trophy cabinet.
Our goal for a long period of time had been to win a gold medal. And coming into the Olympics in London in 2012, we had already played 2 Olympics. We kind of thought in our mind that was our last chance at it. We were already, I think, 35 years old. And we're like, it's now or never. We had won all the Masters Series. We had won all the Slams. We had all the records. But where's the gold? You know, that was kind of the asterisk.
And the greatest team of all time, you know, before us, the Woodies, they had the gold. Everyone knew the Woodies, and they had done that. You know, they had reached the top of the mountain. In tennis, if you don't win the French, there's the next slam. The Olympics, there's a little more sense of urgency because it only comes around every 4 years. You know, you never know how many Olympic teams you're going to be on. And we were the number 1 seed in Athens, didn't get it done, lost a heartbreaker right before the medal rounds to the Chilean team. And then in Beijing, we lose a heartbreaker in the semis. We win the bronze. We think it's the greatest thing in the world. But then we come home to people that are asking us questions. Why didn't you win? So 2012 came around, and it had to happen.
Yeah, coming in, we were playing a little bit shaky, too. We weren't playing that great. In the first round, we should have lost to the Brazilians. We were down a lot of break points for them to serve out the match. And we just got a little lucky. Won a few breakers. And then we won 7 tiebreakers, which on grass, it's a coin flip.
We played Michael Lodra and Joe Wilfried Tsonga in the Olympic final. This is a tough team on grass. Both guys serve humongous, and the margins and doubles are very fine. So in our mind, we believed that we could win, but we knew at any moment it could be taken away from us.
I just remember he had this look in his eye where it was just like, I couldn't snap him out of it. He was like in trance.
Yeah.
And the first game they were serving, and a break on grass is everything. They were serving, they got a little nervous. We got this break point, and I remember they hit a big serve in my backhand, and I just hit it right in the middle of the strings, pure, up the line. It was too good. And then we were just off the races. Like, our energy just lifted up, and we were the best front-running team in the world. When we got up on you, up a break, we rode that. There were no more breaks the rest of the match.
And then we got to the tiebreaker in the second set, and we could see the finish line. And we just looked at each other like, one last push here. And everything started clicking. We got up a lot of points. And I remember match point, a ball got over my head. And I just ran back to the fence. And I just threw it up over my head. I had my back to the net. Ball was a great lob. We got in the point and somehow got it done.
That moment was more like elation. Like I remember I jumped up. We went for the chest bump, but Bob stopped me and grabbed me in the air and held me up.
You felt like you felt like a feather.
Yeah, no, it was cool, and just kind of, this was an emotional one. Like, we didn't really ever get like misty eyed or teary eyed, but to be on the podium and hear the national anthem and have them drape the gold around your neck.
That one took months to really like seep in. You know, I don't even remember being on the medal stand. It didn't really hit until months later. I actually brought the gold medal with me in my racket bag for the whole summer. I was giving it to fans. We'd bring it out after wins, you know, taking it to appearances and just seeing the reaction from people in the room when this shiny gold medal came out of the bag. It was remarkable. And we started to just to really feel the impact of it.
Not just tennis greats, but now Olympic greats too. That took the Bryans to a much broader sporting audience. So what was left to achieve? Well, more of the same. But there was a significant numerical milestone within reach. Their Olympic gold medal was their 79th tour-level title. Could they make it to 100? With 3 more titles in 2012, 11 the following year, and 4 more in the first 8 months of 2014, they arrived at the US Open on 99. Mike first.
We just got hot through the summer. We won 97, 98, 99. And now there's this talk. Are the Bryans going to win 100? Which has never been done before, but at their home slam in front of their friends and the family and U.S. fans. And we did it. We did it. It was just kind of a magical run. We had people fly from all around the world to see this moment. But we were playing so well. We had so much confidence.
It was just meant to be.
Yeah.
It was one of those moments that was just meant to be. There was no stopping it. The crowd was electric in Arthur Ashe Stadium. It was pretty much full house, which is amazing. It seats over 20,000 people. But we had 100 of our friends and family there, you know, that we were looking up there to the box and drawing energy from them. Friends from Stanford, friends from our hometown, family members, parents who usually don't come to see those matches. They were there and we had a hell of a celebration after. But yeah, just holding those numbers. I remember they gave us these big numerals, 100, 100. And it was just like, wow. And that might have been the top of the mountain for us. Just that number was overwhelming, I think, to know that we'd come from just trying to get our first title in Memphis to 100 on the center court of the US Open.
The two freely admit that having been at the top of the mountain, they took their foot off the gas and were somewhat more relaxed after 2014. And it showed. They won just 16 titles in the last 6 years they were on the tour, but they did pick up their intensity in the last couple of years to win trophies into their 40s. So what made the Bryans so good? Sure, they had a great start in life, and as identical twins, the chemistry that all good doubles pairs need was innate to them. But what was it specifically that made them the pair that won 119 titles together? Here's Mike.
I would say one of the qualities that made us so great in doubles was kind of our quick hands and the fact that we had been working on volley drills from like literally a young age. When most kids, when they practice at young ages, they're just working on their ground strokes and their singles games. My dad had this vision where he wanted us to be great doubles players. So we had about like six volley drills that we do pretty much every day, like where we do the quick hands. We had this drill where we call it the RDC drill. So we had all these doubles drills that we were doing from a young age. So it became very natural where we had very soft hands, but quick hands.
And we didn't hit puberty until we were 16, 17. So we were always the smallest guy on the court. So our defensive skills were really heightened and advanced because we're always scrambling. Everyone else was always giving us power and we were always defending. So then when we grew, then we had both parts of the game. And then the serve started popping. We became power players, but we had that defensive skills.
We stayed tremendously focused. And we had this partner in crime to push. He was pushing me every day. I was pushing him. If I was going to the gym, I would drag him with me, and vice versa. The number one lesson that you have to learn in sports is how to lose. I mean, there's a lot of adversity. We won a lot, but we actually lost a lot, too.
I think we probably lost more than any other team.
We lost
out there
300-400 matches, right? And those are all heartbreaking moments.
We dealt with them like a lot of people would, you know, sleepless nights, you know, kind of walking around in a daze or a fog for a couple days. But, you know, eventually you got to get back on the horse. I think what was good about us is that the losses inspired us to work a little bit harder. You know, some people can get discouraged and want to walk away, but it always kind of encouraged us to push each other. And we were mean to each other sometimes. I'm not going to say we were always nice to each other. I knew what Mike could produce, you know, and he knew what I could produce. So that on the practice court every day, I wanted to see that. And he wanted to push me to that level as well.
We had the bar extremely high. I mean, we were kind of insane with, you know, every tournament we played, we wanted to win it. Every practice that we had, we wanted to play our best. I mean, the expectation was just so high. So even losing a final, which a lot of teams would be happy. You know, we made a final. That's a good check. That's good points. We were extremely upset. And a lot of times when you're twins and you're so close, you feel like you can say whatever you want to your brother, even though it's not professional. Hey man, your serve was, you know,
terrible.
Yeah, like, so it can be extremely hurtful, especially when you're emotional after a loss and you're a little bit more sensitive. You can take it the wrong way and then snipe them back, right? And then it goes back and forth. And we did get physical. We got physical a few times, you know, like there were some punches thrown that we're not proud of. But the thing is with twins, we had so many of those, like we could somehow bounce back when guys would never talk to it. Like normal friends would probably never talk to each other again.
But in some ways, that would clear the air. There wasn't a lot of built up resentment. You know, with twins, you let it fly. Terrible things we would say to each other. But a lot of times we just blow it out. Even if I had to give him a little punch and he punched me back, you know, 5 minutes later, we're having dinner. And the next day, we're coming with a clean slate to practice. And we're kind of refocused on the next goal. But you see teams sometimes go through these bad periods where the resentment builds until the team breaks apart. There was never a time where we thought we were going to break up.
Ah, not voluntarily perhaps, but there was a moment when they were forced to break up. That came in 2018 when Bob's hip gave way and he had to have pioneering surgery, similar to that which Andy Murray went on to have, that kept him off the tour for several months. During that time, Mike formed a very successful partnership with Jack Sock, winning two majors and the ATP Finals. So how did Bob handle that?
In 2018, we were having a great run. We were back to number one in the world, but then I blew my hip out. And I was on the sidelines for 9 months while he was going off winning Grand Slams with Jack Sock. And I was a little bit jealous, but I was definitely proud of him. But it really made me appreciate what we had out there together. I was watching him on TV doing these amazing things. And then I got a metal hip put in, rehabbed. He took me back And then we were able to come back and win in our backyard here in Miami, defend our title at the Miami Open in front of, you know, our family, and had our kids on the court with us. And that was just a really emotional moment for me, because you never know if you're going to play again and be out there with your brother again. But defending that tournament in our backyard with a metal hip.
Their intention was to retire at the 2020 US Open, but the COVID pandemic would have made that massively anticlimactic. So their last tour event was their 119th title, close to home in Delray Beach, with their final match, fittingly, a Davis Cup victory over Uzbekistan. With no disrespect to today's doubles players, the Bryans are missed. There'll always be quality at the top of the game, but they had charisma and panache, as well as the ability to win the biggest matches. But when people think back to them, it's important to both twins that the way they conducted themselves should be a big part of the picture. Mike first.
What I hope people remember is that we did love the game of tennis, is we play with a lot of enthusiasm. If you watch us play, we're bouncing around a lot. We love being out there. We love doing it together. And I think it was kind of infectious. They could feel that love for not only each other, the game, doubles. We hope they remember that we love doubles. You know, doubles doesn't get a lot of the attention, but we helped make doubles popular, we hope, during that period of time. And then we hope they remember we stayed and signed the extra autograph. We like to give back. We were once small kids, and we got inspired by, you know, the likes of Andre Agassi and these guys. And so we stayed for, you know, we'd stay for a half hour after matches and just make sure we signed every ball or find every autograph or talk to people. And so
we had doubles aisles as well. You know, we loved the Jensen Bros. They won the French Open in 93, and they were on the cover of every magazine. They would come out on motorcycles to their matches. We loved those guys. We had their temporary tattoos.
Yeah, they made doubles fun. Yeah. They were brothers, but they understood that doubles, it could be entertainment too.
And we loved their loyalty to each other. They always stayed together. So they were our role model as brothers.
And they will have been role models to plenty of other tennis players, whether they made it onto the Pro Tour or not. Arguments will continue about whether the Bryans are the greatest pair of all time. The numbers make a compelling case, but the matches and tournaments they played were shorter than in the 70s and 80s, and fewer singles players played doubles. But they were without question the standard bearers for doubles in the first two decades of the 21st century. And both they and their parents could be assured that the Bryans made a massive contribution to the health and profile of tennis.
That was Chris Bowers charting the career and qualities of two men I had the considerable privilege to work with on the U.S. Davis Cup team, and who are now giving back to today's American team members. They really are inspiring individuals, and it gives me great pleasure as the president of the Hall of Fame that they now have been recognized among the greats of our sport. Do please make your friends, family, and other people aware of this podcast. If you've listened to it, I'm sure you can see that plenty of others will enjoy it too and be inspired by it. The Tennis Worthy Podcast is part of the digital media platform of the International Tennis Hall of Fame. There's always something interesting coming out of Hall of Fame headquarters, so do follow our output. I'm Patrick McEnroe. Thanks for listening.